Hello, welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott. Three-man pod this week. So I'm joined by Chris Baines and Matt Ober. How's it going today, Chris?
Eh. Matt, how you doing?
Hanging in there.
Okay. So about the same. Scott, how are you?
All things considered, pretty fun. Especially with all the basketball news that came later in the week to cover up the football news from earlier in the week.
Okay. So we're just going to just jump right into basketball. This is a hoops podcast now. Are we just done with football?
Yeah. We trudged through the football season like good soldiers. So let's start with football and touch on the Bearcats' loss to South Florida. That's 33-3. Luke Fickell said after the game there were signs of life, and for once, I believe what he was saying. Like, you could see, like, the defensive improvement, I think, was kind of clear from, like, the last month of UC football. But, like, then the offense played their worst game in years, so it was still a 33-3 blowout. What were any of your takeaways from this one, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, like, the defense was markedly better against South Florida than they were against Central Florida. I mean, you're dealing with a different kind of offense, so that, yeah, that has something to do with it. But I think they did a much better job of, you know, a couple of things. They kept Quentin Flowers in the pocket for the most part. They did not give up the amount of big splashy plays that they have been in the previous four or five games, really, let's call it that. They're a lot more solid all around, but they were still, you know, pretty aggressive. So they didn't allow, you know, for most of the season, the trade-off has been that they were a fairly efficient defense that allowed a crap ton of big plays, because it was either a stop for, you know, a gain of a yard or two, or it was a 60-yard touchdown. That seemed to be the only two ways that the defense went. And I guess USF, they were a lot more sound in their alignments and in their execution, so they didn't allow as many of those big plays while they were still pretty good at, you know, keeping them from, you know, those big 7, 8, 9 yard chunk plays that you really need in this day and age of football to be a successful offense. That being said, the offense showed zero life whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of hard to tell whether or not the defense looked, you know, on paper better. I mean, because you're playing an offense where the quarterback he's fine. Quentin Flowers is a solid quarterback, but he's a dual-threat quarterback for a reason. I mean, he's not going to kill you with his arm as much as he will for his legs, which, you know, he definitely did on Saturday, 15 for 85 for 5.3 per clip. But he didn't have any passing touchdowns. He only threw for 184. And for the most part, I mean, the defensive line was able to kind of chew him up and contain him. But then you saw, you know, the week prior against Central Florida, McKinney Milton burned them through the air. And then who knows what's going to happen this Saturday against a pass-happy SMU offense. So I think, you know, on paper, they look better, but in a vacuum, I don't know if this defense is really that much better than they were last week. I guess we'll just find out tomorrow.
Yeah, because overall, I agree with you. Like, I think, like, their effort was definitely there against USF, which I think, not to say their effort was lacking, but, like, their playmaking was a lot better. Because, like, Central Florida and Marshall, like, pretty much did whatever they want. And, like, for the most part, they contained USF. Like, they gave up a lot of yards. But, like, USF wasn't really efficient. And just, like, by the overall numbers, it was their second worst, like, offensive outing of the season. And, like, they didn't give up 30 points. Because the offense gave up a touchdown. Then, like, at the same time, they gave up, like, 200 rushing yards. And there wasn't, like, really any part of the game where it seemed like USF was going to lose. So, just like, you can see the positives, but it's not like there's like a million that stand out because they still lost by 30 points.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's, I mean, the defense isn't the problem with this team, it's the offense, and it just is what it is. I mean, what else can you really say about it that we haven't been saying for weeks and weeks and weeks?
I think the biggest problem with the defense right now is that, like, they're just being on the field forever, and they're ending up in, like, disadvantageous starting positions. It's like, that's something that's really flipped. It's, like, where UC's opponents started. And, like, they're starting closer and closer to, like, the 30. And, like, last year they started like a little further back, like near the 25. It was like a touchback every time. And like now that that's starting to swing, the defense is starting to get more and more exploited. I kind of think those two go hand in hand. Especially when, like, South Florida ran 88 plays. Like, unless you have, like, even with Alabama's defense, 88 plays means you're going to get tired and you're going to make mistakes.
Yeah, and that absolutely was the case with the defense this week. And that, you know, you can't really fault that for the performance against UCF. But this defense is on the field an awful lot because, let's call it, like, the offense isn't good. It's really bad. They cannot string together a couple first downs to give the defense a break. So it seems like after, even if they make a good play, even if they get a third down stop for once in a million years, they're going to be right back on the field in a minute. And not like a minute of game time, like 4 minutes. And they're going to be right back out there because this offense is unbelievably bad. Like, I'm running out of words to describe how bad this offense is. And yet, it seems like nothing is going to change. Nothing at all.
They had 21 first downs against South Florida, and 5 of them were by penalty. They only managed 16, like, first downs, like, with their offense. Like, only 3 scoring opportunities. Just, like, pretty much everything that can go wrong with the offense goes wrong consistently. Like, that's the only consistent thing about the offense, is that they're going to stall out at some point, or they'll have a massive turnover or a costly penalty. Like, there's no drive-to-drive consistency with this team, which is, like, incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, Fickell says it himself. I mean, he's looking for the offense to build momentum, and it's just not there. I mean, they can do what they can, you know, in practice, but it just game to game, it's, you know, every drive is just a crapshoot of whether there's going to be a pick or they're going to get a penalty that kills momentum, or they can't get the ball upfield on the ground, and it's just, there's just nothing there. It's just dead. It's a dead offense.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've been watching UC football for a very long time. I've seen a lot of bad outings, but the consistent ineptitude of this offense has been, it's been tough to handle, because for a decade there, the calling card of this program was the offense. The defense was hit or miss, but the offense was always going to show up. And now it's just not there, and it's not going to be there. And for whatever reason, Fickell does not seem to see the need or have any desire to make a change. And I don't know why. I really don't, because this is a rebuilding process, right? And reps are very valuable. So every time that we just continue to trot out Hayden Moore, it's another series where we don't get to see Ross Drayle. And I don't know that Ross Drayle is the answer. Nobody does. In his limited performances, he hasn't been markedly better than Hayden Moore. But, you know, this is what we know. If this program is going to succeed at the level that Fickell wants it to, this level of quarterback play is not going to be good enough. And we have seen 3 years of football that Hayden Moore is basically this level of play. He's a little bit worse this year than he has been in previous years, and you can chalk that up to any number of things. It could be, you know, having a new offense again, a not-so-good offensive line, maybe inconsistent skill position players. All that being said, but he was wildly inconsistent when he had much better skill position players. When he had Chris Moore and Shaq Washington and those guys, he was still wildly inconsistent. Yeah, he set the school record for passing yards, but he also had some of the worst games, you know, from a quarterback in a big spot that I can remember from a UC quarterback. Yeah, the BYU game comes to mind. So it's not like this is a new development and you know, Hayden Moore is newly bad. He's been what he's been. So going forward, you know, you got five games left in this year. A bowl game is almost certainly out of the question. What are you gaining by trotting Hayden Moore out there game after game, series after series? You know, he is not part of the future, period. He just isn't. But if you continue to treat this, you know, continue to give him reps, like, you're not going to learn anything about the guys that you have. You're not going to learn anything about Ross Taylor. You're not going to learn anything about Sakpo. And you kind of need to learn about those guys. Like, this year's done. It is what it is. Like, you know, ball it up and throw it in the trash. Or, you know, play the young guys and see what you have. And for whatever reason, he just doesn't seem to have any indication that that is the route he wants to take, when that's really the only way forward for this program. Because you have a lot of guys who, young guys who have played already this year. And, like, if anything, they need to start playing even more of them. And you signify that by making a change of quarterback by bringing in a new, you know, some new blood for a guy who's not part of the plans going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the problem, is that we know, like, Hayden Moore is a known commodity. This isn't a guy who's coming off the street and just trying to prove himself. I mean, he's been in the program for 3 years. He has over 2,000 starts and more, I mean, he has more reps on this team than any other quarterback on the roster right now. And the fact is, he had one good game against Memphis. He had a handful of good games after that. I mean, he was fine against Purdue last year. He was relatively fine against a very good Houston team last year. He did, you know, well against Connecticut, except he didn't throw a touchdown. He did well against Tulsa last year. But, I mean, by and large, he's a commodity that he hones in on his number one receivers without working his checkdowns. He doesn't know how to throw an accurate pass to pass. He's not a very good runner. He doesn't have very good arm strength. There's just a laundry list of issues with him. And the problem is that I feel like you're capped out at the quarterback position with Hayden Moore there. And, I mean, the question is, I mean, I have for you guys and I have for a lot of the fans who still think Hayden Moore is the answer. I mean, do you think you lose more games with Ross Trail at quarterback than you do with Hayden Moore? That's my question for you two right now.
I don't think so. I think the bigger problem is the offensive line. But, like, Moore's performance is not getting better. I think that's, like, if he was getting better week to week or month to month, like, I think there would be more cause, like, to keep him as a starter. But I'm kind of, like, it's looking the other way. Like, he's taking his lumps this year because he's going to start next year. And it seems like the coaching staff thinks he's the quarterback of next year. Like, if they're going to be better next year, make a bowl game, and maybe compete for the East, it's going to be because Hayden Moore has a big senior season. That's really the only thing I can see is why he's just going to start the entire year. Like, it seems like they have, like, no, like, preference to change their quarterback position. Which I guess
you're not going to make a.
Go ahead.
You're not going to make a bowl game if your quarterback is averaging 5 yards an attempt. That's my take on it, and that's what he's been averaging for the last 15 games. He's completing 55% of his passes. He has cut down his interceptions a little bit, but he's had better turnover luck this year than he had last year. I mean, he's only thrown six so far, but anybody who's watched the games can tell you that he probably should have a dozen based on his decision making.
And at least half of his interceptions have been pick sixes.
Right. I mean, he's directly contributing to points for the other team. I mean, with those pick sixes, that's one of the biggest problems I have, is that it's one thing if interceptions and turnovers in general are just fluky. I mean, we've seen UC go from the bottom of the barrel to the top in the conference and turnovers and vice versa season to season. The problem is that he's consistently inconsistent throwing the ball, and he's always counted on to throw at least a pick per game. I mean, that's just who he is, and sometimes they're really devastating. Like they were against South Florida, like they were against Michigan. Like it's, it just is what it is with him. Like, I don't get how you look at Peyton Moore in a vacuum against Ross Traill and say, hey, yeah, I can, you know, maybe I don't win as many games against with Hayden Moore over Ross Traill, but I think I'm going to lose less games with Hayden Moore. I don't think you can really say that. Like, I don't understand what the benefit is of starting Hayden Moore right now and continuing to ride him pretty much into the ground.
That's the only thing I can think of. Is like they just wanted him to start next year. I agree with you guys. It's like we know who Hayden Moore is. Like he's, I guess, fine. But like with what they expect from the quarterback position, like fine is not really going to get it done. It's like even if the line was better, like and they had like a running game, like how much of the pressure would that really take off of Hayden Moore? Not a ton, because it seemed like their running game was, like, okay, like, a couple of years ago when, like, Mike Boone was having big games. And, like, even, like, last year to an extent. But like, his accuracy is, like, no doubt still an issue. Like, he's completing 54% of his passes. And with all the short passes they throw, like, he should be, like hypothetically, like, a West Coast offense quarterback should be at least, like, 60%.
If you don't throw the ball more than 10 yards downfield, like more than 4 or 5 times a game, you should not be completing 55% of your passes. You should be completing 65 to 70% of your passes. Like that's the other thing. Like the passes that he's being asked to make are not difficult passes in a vacuum, right? You could probably find 80, 90 quarterbacks in the country who can, in this offense, with these skill position players behind this offensive line, complete at least 60% of their passes. I don't think that's in dispute, but like if your whole offense is based on efficiency and, you know, getting guys the ball in space so that they can make plays, then you have to have a quarterback who can do that. And he can't. Like he just, there is no evidence that he can actually be that kind of quarterback, a precise, accurate, you know, very efficient quarterback. There's no evidence for that. He can be explosive. He can push the ball down the field pretty well. He's got a long history of that. But that's not what this offense is. So, yeah, and then the other thing about it is you can see it in his body language that he is not confident.
Deer in headlights right now.
Like he just looks lost. And for a guy who started as many football games as he has, that's a problem. And I know it was only probably 20, 25 plays, but Ross Traill came in and looked confident, was doing what he was asked to do with, you know, confidence and authority. And that has not been Hayden Moore this year. And I think the steady drumbeat of disapproval with his play has obviously gotten back to Hayden Moore. But he's clearly reading his mentions. Don't ever read your mentions. But he clearly is. And like I don't want to say that he's broken, but it's just like I don't know the way back from that. Because if he's going to engage with that kind of stuff at that level and let it affect him to the degree that he has, I don't know that it's going to get better with time, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is, like, I would assume Fickell has a pretty good handle on his program now, and he seems like a logical coach. He's in the heads of his players. He understands what they're thinking and stuff like that. And he's a player's coach. To your point, Matt, I mean, Hayden Moore doesn't look like the type of quarterback that came in against Memphis 3 years ago. He looks like a broken and beaten down quarterback that's aged 10 years to the day. Like, I don't understand how Fickell sees him week to week, day to day, and says, yeah, this is a guy that is confident enough to lead my offense. And maybe that's just him taking a step back and letting Mike Denbrock run the show. Maybe this is Mike Denbrock's problem. I don't know what it is, but I mean, from what we saw from Ross Drayle on Saturday in very limited time, I don't understand how his demeanor, Ross Drayle's demeanor, looks any worse than Hayden Moore's right now. Like, regardless of the stats.
I think the biggest problem with Moore is I think it is his confidence. Because it's like, once things start going wrong, like, it seems like it's really hard for him to snap out of it. Like, Michigan, like, he had a couple of fine drives, and well, like, he threw a pick, and then, like, he like, was wild the rest of the game. Like, Navy, like, he had another, like, big monster game. Like, one of his best games of the season. His best game of the season by far, I would say. Not counting Austin Peay, where he's pretty efficient. And, like, then he followed that with, like, kind of a dud against Marshall. So it's, like, really hard to, like, I don't know. It's just, like, really hard to see where your offense goes if, like, your quarterback is kind of, like, not reliable. Because, like, efficiency-wise, this offense is second worst in the nation. Like, explosive-wise, they're, like, pretty explosive for, like, a team with a terrible offense. Like, their, like, running success rate, like, on, like, known rushing downs is 127. Their passing success rate on known passing downs is 119. Like, that's pretty terrible. And I really don't know how it gets better. Like, even if they start Ross Drayle, like, maybe he can run and get you out of some positions. But I don't know. It's like their offense is just such a mess. They kind of need to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Is like, you're bottomed out in so many areas. Why not just give it a damn shot and let Drayle start for a couple of weeks? Like, what? Like, how does that really hurt you that much? Like, does it really? Like, I would get if, like let's say Ross Drayle is a senior and Hayden Moore is a sophomore, and you just want to see what you're going to get out of Hayden Moore and build his lumps. But we got a reverse situation here. I mean, Hayden Moore is the junior and Drayle is a sophomore. Give him a shot. Just see what he can do. Like, you're playing for bowl games, yeah. But again, I don't think Ross Drayle loses you the same games that Hayden Moore would, or more games than Hayden Moore would. That's the thing. Like, just give him a chance. Like, that's all I want. And I don't know how Fickell can get in front of the press and constantly say that Hayden Moore is going to be a starter when he has to defend him every week after every game when Hayden Moore throws a pick six, like, every other game. Like, I don't know how that just doesn't drive him crazy.
No, I think it does drive him crazy. I think the cognitive dissonance of that is weighing on him. He was noticeably less upbeat in his press conference this week than he has been in the past couple of weeks, even while saying, we're closer, we're turning the corner. Slowly, but we're turning the corner. And that might be the case. That might be the feeling in the offices. But, you know, it's just... The bottom line is the level of quarterback play that they have gotten from Hayden Moore is not good enough, period. And I get that he is out, like, his job is to defend his players. I get that. But you can defend your players while being honest, while saying, yeah, we haven't really got what we wanted out of Hayden Moore this year. No, he's a very talented player. He has upside, but we just haven't seen it. You can say that. Like, that's a lie, but that's palatable and acceptable, and it placates the people who are wondering if you actually know football, because what we've seen from Hayden Moore, it's just not good enough, period. Bottom line, It's not good enough. And if you say you want to be the class of the program, you can't have a quarterback doing this. And there's no evidence that giving him more starts is going to make him better. And he could magically have a spectacular senior season if you just continue to give him the ball. But I've watched a lot of Hayden Moore. I don't see how he is ever going to be consistent down to down, let alone game to game. It's just not in him.
Yeah, and I think I don't really think Fickell would actually ever call out like Hayden Moore like that in a presser. I mean, I totally get like what you're saying. You can definitely call out a player in a tactful manner, but I think for Fickell, he's still in a state with this program where he's still building equity as a head coach. Like, I think he's still thinking long term. Like, he still has to be that coach's player and someone that recruits will look to, and recruits' families will look to have their back no matter what. Now, if he's in year three, he's winning 8 to 9 games a season, and he's built up that equity as a head coach, he can start saying those kinds of things, but I think he still has to be very tactful and very careful with what he says about players in press conferences. And I totally agree. I think the Hayden Moore issue is weighing on him. My problem is why isn't he handling it behind the scenes and making a decision like that? Like, even beyond what he's talking about to the press. I mean, my problem with Fickell right now is that he's got a boatload of evidence on his plate, and he's not evaluating that evidence appropriately. And that's my biggest issue. Now, is that him making the call? Is he over-trusting Denbrock? Is he letting Denbrock make the call? Is he trying to focus on defense and letting Denbrock 100% control the offense without trying to, you know, get his hands dirty? I don't know. But I would hope at some point the light comes on and he says, okay, Hayden, you're done. We're going with Ross. We just have to. I mean, I'll sit you down man-to-man and tell you exactly why, but at this point, we have to go with Ross. We have to see what he can do. And I don't know. I don't know why that epiphany hasn't hit him yet. Yeah. I don't know. How long have we spent just basically ripping on Ross or ripping on Hayden?
About 20 minutes.
Oh, 30 minutes. Okay, great. I don't think we really talked about anything else in the football game other than just ripping on Hayden Moore and Fickell's decision to start him. But we can keep going if you guys want. I mean, I've got till noon, so.
I think we've talked that issue to death.
At the very worst, I don't really know like why you wouldn't just generically say like you're opening up competition.
Or that, yeah, I agree, Scott. Yeah, say something like that. Like I totally get if you're coming back from the Tuberville era where he played musical chairs with the quarterback every week in press conferences and stuff. But I mean, I think no one would fault Fickell from coming out and saying, "Yeah, we're going to open it up again and just see what these guys can do."
Unless they just really don't blame Hayden Moore for like the offense as a whole being terrible. Like, this has got to be the worst offense since UC was terrible like 20 years ago. Like, their S&P offense is 113. Points per game is just a pure stat. They're 117 in the country. Like, I don't really know how, like, you can't just look in the mirror like and judge the offense as a whole. Like, it's like what they played, how many games now? Like, 7 games. And you're still not averaging like 100 yards rushing a game, which is like seems like impossible to do in this league. I don't know, but some of like Denbrock's things on offense kind of like confuse me a little bit.
Yeah, I know, Scott. You're not Denbrock's biggest fan.
They did run the ball overall pretty well, except for the sacks, like lost them a ton of yards. But, like, still, they average under 3 yards a rush. And, like, if you don't have any balance on offense, like, that just makes everything worse for everybody. Like, passing-wise and rushing-wise, they have no balance with their passing game or their rushing game. You can't lean on one or the other because they're both been terrible.
Yeah, and the running game is another reason why I think Trail needs to get a shot, because he is a much more effective, efficient runner. And having a running quarterback makes a bad offensive line look better because it changes the math. Like, so instead of having to there's one less guy to block because the defense has to account for the quarterback every time. Right now, they don't have to account for Hayden Moore, and they don't, which is why Hayden Moore has the longest run of the season for anybody, because it was a play where Michigan just straight forgot that he was there, and he just kind of took the ball and lumbered for 40-something yards. But they haven't consistently used a quarterback in the running game. And when you have an offensive line like this that is not good, it's not that talented, you need to figure out ways to scheme around that. And the easiest way to do it is to have a quarterback back there who is a threat to run. And right now they don't, because that's the choice they made. I mean, that's just, we're getting back into the same issue, but that's another check in Ross Drill's favor, is that he at least changes the dynamics of the running game a little bit.
Just based on pure running numbers, if Hayden Moore runs for 13 yards and Mike Boone is still injured, Hayden Moore will be the second leading rusher on the team.
For a guy who's not a threat and who just occasionally scrambles for a lot of yards. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there's no systematic attempt to exploit it. And, like, it's not that Hayden Moore is an oak tree back there. He can move around a little bit, but he's not, you know, he's not super quick or explosive, which is kind of what you need from your quarterback in the running game. You need that 5-yard speed, and Hayden doesn't have it. I mean, when he gets up to top speed, it's good. It just takes him 15 yards to get there.
Yeah, and I think no one on this team is saying that Hayden, or no one on this podcast is saying that Hayden Moore is the defining issue with this offense. Like, this offense would be, you know, Clemson-esque if Ross Drill was playing above Hayden Moore. No, this offense has issues at offensive line. There's issues at receiver. But, I mean, you mitigate some of those issues by having a better quarterback there. Like, if your offensive line can't block for shit, and Hayden Moore is in there just staring at the number one receiver without getting to his checkdowns, that's a problem. If Ross Drill checks down better and finds the 2 or 3 option underneath a lot quicker than Hayden Moore, then he's a better option. If he's a better runner and the offensive line breaks down, he's able to slip out of the pocket and pick up 5 or 6 yards on the ground because he's a better runner than Hayden Moore, then Ross Drill is your better option. That's the problem I have with this decision making to continuously go with Hayden Moore. You know you have weak spots all over the offense. I don't understand how you think that Hayden Moore is really going to be that guy to really hide those issues for you.
Yeah, and to that end, like, the offense they've been played a ton of people, period. Like, there have probably been 12 receivers who have gotten run this year. There have been 3 running backs. You know, the two freshmen have gotten a lot of run. The offensive line, they've started, I think, 4 different combinations. None of them have been particularly effective, but they're in the other areas, you can see that they are trying different things. You can see that they're trying different people to see if they can find some combination that magically will make this offense a little bit more effective. But they still have the same quarterback. So it's like you're willing to try and experiment and go with the youth movement in all these different areas, but you're not willing to do it with the most visible position, the one that is causing everyone anxiety. That I don't get. It's like, if you're willing to play a freshman at receiver or running back, why are you not willing to play a younger guy who doesn't have Hayden Moore's experience at quarterback? Why?
And I think that's one of my biggest questions as well, is you see the youth movement at every single other position other than quarterback. And my only devil's advocate answer to that is maybe Fickell and Denbrock's answer at quarterback is sitting in high school right now playing his senior year in Illinois. Like, maybe they don't think Ross Drill or Jake Sopko or Hayden Moore or Desmond Ridder or whoever is the answer at quarterback. I mean, Ben Bryant will be an early enrollee. He'll be here for spring practice. Maybe their long-term plan is, maybe they think this season, they know in the back of their minds this season is a wash, and their long-term plan is to start Ben Bryant as a true freshman, you know, in September of next year. Maybe that's their plan.
Okay. But if that's your plan,
I'm just saying, that's the devil's advocate. That's just the devil's advocate.
I get it. And like, don't think that that thought has not run through the back of my head many times while watching this team. But that puts a ton of pressure on a young quarterback, and we don't know how he's going to react to that. Because if he comes in here, and like let's be real, he's watching these games in his head. He's like, oh God, I'm going to start next year. I got this. You kidding me? You look at these guys? I got this. But that's still, like, that's not a level of pressure and expectations that I'm willing to put on a true freshman quarterback early enrollee for the season where your program is supposed to be turning the corner.
No, that wouldn't be the plan I would put in place. But again, I'm not being paid $3 million a year to make those decisions. I mean, the plan I think we've all talked about is Ross Trail. He starts the next two seasons. You either redshirt Ben Bryant next year, or you put him behind Ross Trail, let him play in garbage time, and then you gradually grow him into that starter in a couple of years. But, you know, maybe they're going a different way. I don't know.
You know, for all the complaining everybody did about UC quarterbacks being hurt and, like, never playing a full season, like, one's playing a full season, everybody's mad.
Yeah, the last quarterback to play a full season was Dustin Grusa, and he did not have a stellar season.
Maybe that's the key to playing a full season, is like you just have to be
really, really mediocre.
You don't do anything too impressive or too terrible, and like you can make the whole season.
Yeah, you want to stay under the radar of the angry Cincinnati hating quarterback god. You want to stay under that radar.
I think it's interesting. Ross Trail played, what, like two drives against South Florida? And counting sacks, he had six carries, which tied him for the team leading carries. I don't know why they don't give the ball to the running backs more. Is there anything else you guys want to touch on with USF, or do you want to move on to SMU?
I mean, we could potentially talk about literally anything else in that game other than the quarterback play, and I guess we talked about a little bit the running back play, but I think it might be time to move on.
I don't even think it's the running back play. I just don't understand why they don't give the ball to their backs, who are their only playmakers on offense, besides Khalil Lewis, I think, and sometimes Devin Gray. Like,
well,
like
I mean,
Warren had 47 yards, Dokes had 37 yards, and if they don't run it, they don't really throw it to him. It's like, I just don't understand. Like, if those guys are by far your biggest playmakers, why are they touching the ball 7 and 6 times a game?
Yeah, I mean, part of that, I think, is, and I'm totally with you there. I think they really should start spreading some of those guys out and getting them involved in the passing game a little more. But I think one of the reasons they're not running the ball that much is that they're down, like, you know, 20 points by, like, the second quarter. And they have no other option but to pass.
Hey, they were down 20 points until that unfortunate untimed down.
Dear God. The down we'll never speak of.
Yeah, they were hanging in there, being very, 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 very bad at red zone offense. And they were still only down by 6 points. And then things happened.
Yeah.
We should talk about that play. And
We just said we wouldn't.
Everything about
all right, fine. Play, talk about it.
Everything about that play was just so crazy. Like, they got the read, like Hayden Moore made. It looked like somebody ran the wrong route because it was such a crazy throw. And then everybody's attempts at tackling were unbelievably hilarious. It's like nobody knew how to tackle, and that guy like had a crazy long touchdown. Get red zone offense, like trip, like points per inside the 40. Like, UC is only averaging 3.94 points when they get inside the other team's 40. I know, like, that wasn't a play inside the 40, but Matt brought it up, and that's just a crazy stat. Anyway, yeah. Like, what a crazy
stat. And it's not that somebody ran the wrong route. It's that Hayden Moore made a hilariously bad decision. Because the play that they ran is four verts, which is it's different than a Hail Mary, but it stretches the field, the width, of the field. So you basically got somebody at the numbers, somebody at the hashes. You know, both hashes, both numbers. So you spread their quarter's defense, and you got basically one-on-one coverage everywhere. And he still managed to throw it into triple coverage.
Well, the thing about that is that he threw the ball way too early. Like the receiver barely even was looking for the football. I mean, he only ran like 15 yards downfield by the time Hayden Moore was trying to hit him. Like, why do you think four verts makes you think that you shouldn't, that you should throw the ball after 15 yards? Like double clutch and throw it when he's like 30 or 40 yards downfield, which is when you should be doing it. Like, I don't know, maybe he thought the receiver was going to come back on some kind of cutback or something like that, but I did not understand that decision. That made no sense to me.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't trying to imply somebody did run the wrong route. That's just like what his throw looked like, with how weird a decision it was. Like you said, triple coverage. Like, even if that guy was like there, like that pass was going to get broken up or intercepted every single time. And like you said, Chris, yeah, like he threw it at like the 40. Like the guy was like, it was like a 60-yard interception return.
And USF was in pre-vet, so the DBs were like 25 yards back and backpedaling from the start. Like, the receivers didn't even hit the defensive back level when he threw the ball. Which is why it was triple coverage. Because the under defenders were still there. Yeah. Weird. That was a weird play. On to the next thing.
Yeah, who are they playing this Saturday? Like, SMU? Should be a good game for those people who watch.
Yeah. SMU. Another team coming off a bye week. It still seems unfair. This team needs every advantage it can get in that a week of the opponent scheming for them and putting up like 450 yards. SMU's offense, very good. Like, they rank 12th in the nation, and they're 6th in points per game. They score a lot of points, obviously. Their defense is not very good. It can be like a Navy-type game, just kind of the vibe I'm getting. It could be a Navy-type game or a Marshall-type game. It's kind of hard to tell.
Well, SMU plays no defense, so this should be the most favorable defense UC has faced since, I don't know, Miami? I mean,
Since Navy.
You want to say Navy? All right, we'll call it Navy. I don't know. I assume that just that SMU has like one of the worst defenses in the nation. So I don't know. On paper, this should be a good offensive day for Cincinnati. But I mean, the fact that SMU runs a pass happy offense just like USF or Central Florida, just worries me. That it's going to be like, to your point, Scott, a Navy type shootout.
Yeah, I still think that this is going to be a game where the defense is on the field for 80 plays. Which is, as we know, not their best.
SMU's running game is very efficient as well. They don't have anybody who like really stands out. I guess Xavier Jones is averaging 6 yards a carry. But like they really move the ball on the ground. So it seems like if they can, the defense can't get off the field, going to be a long day. Like, I know SMU doesn't force like a ton of turnovers either, but like it seems like Hayden Moore could give him one or two. Even if he doesn't throw picks, the fumbles have been a problem his whole entire UC career. And like we saw against Marshall, like he had a crucial fumble against Marshall that really turned the beginning of that game, like the first half avalanche. Like, if they can avoid the turnovers, they should be able to move the ball on SMU. But, I don't know, it seems like a pretty big hit.
Yeah, SMU is third in the conference in first downs. They're 5th in third down conversions. They're 4th in fourth down conversions. I mean, I don't know. This is just an offense that just knows how to stay on the field or just pile up first downs. Both things seem to just work against Cincinnati's defense. Like, I don't think this is going to be, like, regardless of whatever UC does offensively, I mean, Cincinnati's going to give up probably like 40 to 45 points in this game. I just feel that. And I just don't know how UC responds. Like, do they cave like Marshall, or do they keep up like Navy?
I mean, it really depends on if they have any early success, because that was the key with the Navy game, is that they had a couple big explosive plays early, and that kept them in the game. And after the Navy machine established itself, the offense still kept up. But if the first quarter goes badly, and they have a couple of bad drives, and they don't get on the board, it's going to snowball. You know, we've documented Hayden's issues with you know, his own confidence. And if this game starts to go pear-shaped early, it's going to be rough.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for as well, like the early start. The SMU, like just by like the numbers, like in points and everything, like they've been off to good starts. They led TCU like pretty early, who's probably the best team either one of these teams has played this year.
By far.
It seems like their big problem is, like SMU's big problem is, the third quarter. That's where things go crazy for them. But if you're down like, I don't know, like 20-3 at halftime, that kind of like mitigates that a little bit. Like not falling down into a huge hole is like incredibly important, because like the last two home games, like UC's just been buried by halftime. Like there's nothing they really could have done against Central Florida, and there was really nothing they could have done against Marshall after you're down. Was like 30-7 at halftime or whatever crazy score it was. So, yeah, it's like a kind of like a big issue of like not falling into a terrible trap. And I really don't know if they can avoid it.
The history of the season would suggest that no, they can't, because they have not shown any ability to, you know, dodge those landmines. They just kind of walk right into them. It's like, oh shit, I don't have an ankle anymore. That's the problem.
And UC playing any team that doesn't have like terrible special teams like worries me. And SMU's special teams look like they're like kind of average. So, yeah, that part worries me as well.
Yeah, SMU, third best team in the league according to S&P Plus. Just like everybody predicted.
Yeah, it's going to be, I don't know. I think we're going to be saying the same things about this team this time next week that we have for the last three or four Thursday, Fridays. I don't know. I think until Cincinnati plays an offense that will at least, I guess, at least go a little easier on them, like, I don't know, Temple, East Carolina, or UConn, we're gonna be basically saying the same things about this team. Like, this team defensively and offensively are guilty and proven innocent in my mind. Like, they look better against South Florida, but I still think that's more about how South Florida and how they run their offense than anything UC was really doing.
Yeah, and it was weird. Like, it almost seemed like South Florida lost with all their comments after the game, with how mad they were about their performance against UC. It's like, but I guess that's a good thing at the same time, because at least they were mad.
That means I think they were mad because of how bad they looked against lowly UC. Is how I interpreted those comments. But
one big key are the turnovers. SMU's turnover margin is 8, which is 6th best in the nation. So that probably is not going to be great if UC turns the ball over, since SMU avoids that like pretty well.
Yeah, that fits right into UC's hands, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're really good against offenses. Yeah, they're really good against offenses that avoid turnovers, because that dovetails very nicely with UC's refusal to force anybody to commit turnovers. It's been great. Only 2 interceptions on the year. I think they've recovered more fumbles than they've picked off passes. That's not ideal.
Yeah, like the lack of like turnovers is kind of like head scratching in a way. Like, you really think, like, with their secondary, Like, I don't know if it's like the coverages they call, or if like they just don't have like guys with like those kind of like go for broke instincts. Like the secondary has one interception, and it came like it was a gift, like a gift interception, and Brian Wright had a pick. And it doesn't, like, it seems like they break up passes like pretty fine. Like Brandon Stevens like does that well, but like then he doesn't have a pick. So I don't know. It's kind of head scratching. I don't know if it's the coverage or like the execution.
It helps to intercept the ball if you're within, you know, 5 yards of a receiver. I've heard that helps.
Probably does help. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, call me crazy, but I've just heard that helps.
Yeah, I think they've been way too passive in the last month or so. Because when they started the year, they were ultra aggressive. And I think that better suits this personnel than the more conservative style they've been playing recently. And like their havoc rate among linebackers and defensive backs is terrible. Like they're just not impacting the opposing offense at all. And if you're gonna play this personnel group with all this speed and you're not gonna have them just flying around trying to make plays, it's really putting them at a disadvantage because they're not gonna hold up. You know, they're not gonna hold up against power at all. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why the run defense has become so bad, is that they're not committing bodies to blitz and be aggressive like they were early in the year. And I get it, like they gave up a lot of big plays early in the year, and they're not allowing quite as many right now. But they're a very easy defense for offenses to prepare for.
It's like, what are the odds we're going to see the same play actions or double moves that we saw, like Marshall run and UCF run? Not really USF. They didn't really run a ton of double moves, at least any that worked. It's like SMU's going to run the ball like quite a bit. Like, we just know that from Chad Morris's like MO. And that seems like that always opens up some type of big passing game for UC.
Yeah, I mean, they're not really great against play action. And part of that is they're not getting a good pass rush at all. They're very disruptive against the run. They have a lot of tackles for loss, but they do not have sacks. The ends have been a disappointment. And part of that is Brian Wright has had a good season when healthy, but he hasn't been fully healthy since probably week two.
Yeah, that was one of the bigger disappointments of the USF game. Like, he was healthy to play, then he got for, what, like 10 minutes into the game? Or 10 minutes into his action?
Yeah, he just hasn't had a healthy year. And football, health is a skill. It really is. And he's just had, I don't know if it's bad luck or he's injury prone. It's too early to tell. It's the first year where he's really playing. But, you know, he's shown flashes when he's on there that he can be a really impactful defensive end. But you got to be on the field to make an impact.
Yeah, so I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, overall, I mean, I've kind of made my peace with it. I don't think they win this Saturday. I think UC gives up 40, 45 points, loses by, I don't know, by a touchdown or two. What do you guys think?
I think it gets ugly.
Like worse than that?
I think there's 10,000 people in the stands after halftime.
So worse than that, okay.
I think the potential for this to go off the rails is pretty high. I don't trust the offense to do enough, and SMU's offense is consistent enough and explosive enough that, like, they're going to make some plays. Like, they have, like, NFL talent at receiver. And, like, UC hasn't done really well against any type of NFL talent on the other side. So, like, in that sense, it seems like they're going to give up at least 40. And can the offense hang with them? Like, I think maybe, like, for a half. Or, like, they make a little run in the third quarter or early in the fourth. But I just don't see it. I'm going to say, like, 45 to 21.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
I fully expect them to be down by 21 points by the time I get home from work at 5:30. That's where my head's at with this one. I fully expect to come home and be like, all right, I'm going for a run.
Maybe 45 to 21 was too big of a margin. Maybe it'll be 45 to 21 and UC will finish somewhere. So it ends up being 45 to like 35 or 48 to 35. It's going to be a lot of points given up. And if I thought about it earlier, I would have done the research to see the last time UC gave up so many points back-to-back-to-back at home. But it was probably 1998, because every bad stat is 1998.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all kind of comes down to turnovers. If UC's starting to let the turnovers pile up is where you start to see the margin grow. If they somehow take care of the ball and we only throw like one pick or have one fumble the entire game is where I think it's going to be a little closer. But I mean, I think somewhere within like the 40 to 45 points allowed range and depending on turnovers is, you know, UC either scores around 35 or they score around 21. And I think either prediction is probably pretty valid.
Like, even if, like, they move the ball, like, you really have to worry about them finishing in the red zone. Like, I mentioned that number earlier. They've been really terrible at that. And, like, it's not like their kicking game has gotten any better. Like, you can't really rely on any kicker you have, like, fair or foul. So that really hurts your, scoring chances. Like, when it's touchdown or bust, and then, like, your offense, like, dies at the 30. There's really nothing you can do. And, like, that seems like it's been one of the bigger problems for the offense all season long.
For the last, like, three seasons, let's be real.
Yeah. Fair point.
It's tough to win games scoring three. It's very tough.
It's like, just, like, look at SMU's number. SMU, like, once they get inside the 40, they're scoring 4.92 points. Which is 28th in the nation. Like, the national average is 4.83. Like, if, like, you just, like, know you're going to score, like, points once you get inside the 40, like, that's such a huge boost to your offensive confidence. Instead of, like, oh, we're inside the 40. Let's hope it doesn't go sideways.
Yeah. It could get kind of ugly on Saturday. We could basically be looking at the same script that we saw the last 3 weeks. So, we'll see.
Yeah, which is pretty disappointing because if they do get beat in this game, how many people are going to be at the Temple game? Like, seven?
Like, yeah.
How many people were going to be at the Temple game to begin with? Then how many people are going to be at the Temple game if they're 2-7 or 3-6, like not very many.
I mean, to see FanSport pick up, they've got it. They've got to steal one of the next two games. They just have to figure out how to do it. I mean, that's the only way. You've got to dangle the carrot of a bowl game out there to get people at the Temple game. I mean, that's the only way you do it.
It's going to take a large upset to get to a bowl game, right? Because they're not going to be. They have to upset either SMU or Tulane. And I know it's very weird to say upset Tulane in the context of Cincinnati football, but that's where we are. They have to upset one of those two, and then they have to run the table against Temple, East Carolina, and UConn. I don't have much confidence in that.
It's like easy to like look at Temple, East Carolina, and UConn. Like, oh, look at those teams; they're really bad. So Cincinnati's like right down there with them. Just the saddest part about this season is UC is like really like the S&P difference between UC and UConn is six spots. like if UConn wins, or if it has like a, I don't know who UConn plays. I haven't looked at the schedule like the last minute. But like if UConn plays like well, like there's a good chance Cincinnati could fall behind them. UConn plays Tulsa. There's even a chance they could win, and UC would have like the second worst like computer numbers in the league, which would be incredibly depressing, since this bottom of this league is really terrible.
Yeah, when your goals at the end of the season are to finish and just finish somewhere in the double digit in the S&P rankings, I mean, you know you're not having a very good season. Like, yeah, just I mean, not finish in triple digits.
That's been the weird thing about the league this year is how there's an upper class and there's a lower class. There's no middle. Tulane is the middle.
Which is good, honestly. I mean, if you're looking at, like, I mean, Matt, you posted the G5 S&P rankings as well. I mean, Central Florida is 9, South Florida is 18. And then there's a pretty big gap to Southern Miss at 31. I mean, if you're looking at the league as a whole and wanting to separate itself from the G5 and be that Power 6 conference, I mean, this is exactly what you want. You want to have that upper class and that lower class.
Yeah, but you don't want your bottom five teams to be 100 or worse. You want them to be like 70 to 80 or 70 to 90. Like, this league is very good. It's the best of the rest. It just is and has been since it got kicked out of automatic qualification, whatever you want to call it. But they need to strengthen the bottom of the league. And that comes down to making good hires. But some of these jobs, like, UConn's hopeless. It is what it is. They don't really have... They have the resources, but they don't have the recruiting grounds. Nobody wants to coach there. It's a dead-end job. Everybody knows it. But the rest of these programs can and should be better. Like, Tulsa should be way better. Temple... This is probably as bad as Temple should be. The ECU is really, really not helping things.
But that's the thing is, like, if you're looking at, like, just the conference prestige, like, having no fandom at all to any particular team at all, I would rather have this situation where you have a couple of undefeateds at the top and complete dog shit at the bottom, because the problem with this conference during years they don't make the Access Bowl is they're fighting with a Western Michigan team that goes undefeated because they don't play anybody. Like, their conference is terrible, so they just wreck teams. And then if any of the teams at the top of the AAC start to stumble because they're playing against better talented teams week to week, they get screwed out of the Access Bowl. So, I mean, I'd almost rather have this situation where there is an undefeated team coming out of the AAC, even if they have to play the wrecks at the bottom of the league, then have a situation where there's too much parity at the top. And then UC, or not UC, but then AAC team gets jumped by, like, an undefeated MAC team or something like that. See, yeah. I hate that situation.
And the funny thing, like, I only did the top 10 this week. Next week, I don't know. I might do the top 15. But if you look at the list, like, there's two or three more AAC teams that would be right after Toledo.
Yeah, and Memphis is going to jump off because they won last night. So yeah, I get that point.
I think like the flip side to your argument, Chris, is couldn't you just say, like, if somebody was just good the entire season, like Houston was a couple years ago, like they made the run to the Access Bowl, and like the league was better a couple years ago than it was now.
It's like, yeah,
if USF and UCF were, like, really that great, like, they could run through the league if it was pretty solid. It's, like, really, like, the disparity in the East is a lot starker than the West, because at least you have, like, Houston and, like, Navy and Memphis, like, in the West. And, like, the East, it's just the two Florida schools this year, and everybody else is, like,
hilariously terrible.
Like, among the worst 30 teams in the nation.
Right, and I think that makes sense. It's just the problem is that we're looking at S&P rankings, which are far more accurate than what we look at in, like, an AP or coaches poll or a college football playoff poll. Like, there's scenarios out there where UCF, SMU, or not SMU, UCF, USF, and let's say Memphis now, could have beaten each other up at the end of the season, finished with a higher S&P ranking, and an undefeated San Diego State could have stolen the Access Bowl. Just because that's just how the perception in the AP and coaches and the college football playoff rankings work.
Yeah,
and I think that's my problem. I totally get that. A Central Florida and SMU could pretty much run through the conference, but they could get tripped up along the way near the end of the season, and then an undefeated team from another group of five conference that played a dog shit schedule sneaks into the Access Bowl.
But you could just also argue that if you don't have any good teams in your league, or at least your division, or on your schedule. Just go on your schedule. Take USF's schedule. And, you just play nobody the entire year, which they pretty much do. Nobody's going to talk about you. It's going to be hard to climb up the rankings. And they've seen the struggle climbing up the rankings until, they just started exploding offensively. To your point, nobody watches their games. If their scores don't look good, the first couple of weeks of the year, it's like, oh, maybe USF isn't that great. Or when UCF starts blowing people out by 30 points a game. That's really the only way to make people take notice. I see your point on that one. And if somebody's undefeated, they definitely have an easier road to go. Who made the Access Bowl last year? I don't even remember.
Yeah, it was Western Michigan. It was Western Michigan because they went undefeated. They went 12-0 because...
Oh, yeah, that's right. They went to the Cotton and got annihilated.
Right. Well, here's the problem. Before San Diego State lost last week, they were sitting at 19th in the AP poll, the second G5 team. 18th was South Florida. If South Florida lost, if South Florida lost to Cincinnati last week, all of a sudden San Diego State's in the driver's seat for that Access Bowl. That's the biggest problem I have. unfortunately, there's only one slot, and that slot, anyone who's undefeated and higher in the rankings has an automatic inside track to that Access Bowl. Unfortunately, that's just the world we live in.
But at least the AEC is in a bit of a power position compared to some of the other ones. Because take Southern Miss. I don't know what their record is, but if Southern Miss was undefeated, they wouldn't start getting any pull momentum till about this time of year. It's like a team like one of the Florida schools could hypothetically take a loss and still be ahead of them. It's like that second loss that always gets you.
I don't know. Yeah, I think that, yeah, the second loss hurts. Western Michigan, let's see, what were they on week 15? Western Michigan was 13-0. They were 15th in the country. And the only G5 team behind them was, a 9-3 Navy team. So, yeah, Western Michigan, I think that probably makes sense. But in the scenario of last week, if San Diego State goes undefeated against a pretty bad Mountain West schedule and Central Florida, South Florida, and Memphis are continuing to beat themselves up at the top of the AAC, it only hurts the AAC. So I don't know. I totally get what you guys are saying. I want to see a top to bottom stronger league, but the risk you run there is that you can get jumped by an undefeated Mountain West or MAC team. But I don't know. I guess at the end of the day, if you have a stronger conference top to bottom, what comes out of that is that you start beating better Power 5 teams in your non-conference schedule, and you start off league play at a higher ranking. So you're off on a better foot that way, I guess. I don't know.
I think you're kind of right. It is kind of a weird conundrum because you'd like the league to be better, but the same time, you kind of would like it to be the Mountain West and be a three team top heavy. It's your teams is going to be at least ranked in the top 25. It seems like if it's not Boise, it's somebody else in that league. It seems to always be ranked. This year was San Diego State and Boise State. I think was close to the rankings early. I don't remember. Yeah, because we've seen Memphis start off pretty hot. They had that big win against Ole Miss a couple years ago. Then they lose once, and nobody talks about them ever again. It is a tricky thing. So, you want your league to have more key games. like if you want your team like to make the playoff, or not the playoff, but the access bowl, you want your league to kind of suck. It's a weird conundrum.
Yeah. I mean, like, theoretically, like, if your league overall is better top to bottom, those teams at the top are knocking off some ranked teams, hopefully Power 5 ranked teams, just by playing them in the non-conference play, and then you're building a better resume overall than that undefeated San Diego State or MAC team that just basically ran the table against a horrible strength of schedule. And you'd hope that the college football playoff would look at that and say that, yeah, even if you lost one game, you still beat one or two ranked teams on your schedule, and you, AAC team, played a better schedule against than undefeated MAC team. I mean, you would hope that would be the case. So, I don't know, I can see both sides.
You have any thoughts about this one, Matt?
No, I mean, like, you're better served if the quality of your league is better top to bottom than to have the dregs like you see, like this league has in the East right now. And UCF and USF are very, very good, and they would be very, very good if they were not playing in the AAC East. But playing in the AAC East definitely helps them. They get some breathers.
Oh, sure, because they basically get glorified practices for a few games.
All of the games, other than the times they play each other.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's basically. Just, yeah, go ahead.
Well, the West is completely chaotic, right? Memphis is the best team, I guess. But they had a miraculous comeback last night, but they're not a consistently good team at all. Navy is good, but they're not as good as previous Navy teams have been. SMU might be the best top-to-bottom team in the division. Maybe. Houston has the most talent. They don't seem to be using it particularly well. I mean, the West is pretty crazy right now, is my general takeaway from this. But, like, all of the teams in the West are better than the rest of the teams in the East, with the one exception of Temple being slightly better than Tulsa. That's it. But everybody else is, nobody's worse than 80th. And most of them are in the 40s.
It's an interesting discussion, I think, to have at least. Kind of interesting to note the AAC champion last year finished unranked. South Florida finished 19th in the polls. So I guess that really didn't matter in the grand scheme. Let's run through the schedule real quick from last week before we touch on this week. UCF destroyed East Carolina. You mentioned, Matt, that Memphis beat Navy. Then Memphis, like, last night with that huge comeback, like, knocked off Houston. They scored with, like, a minute and a half left to take the lead. Memphis' schedule looks pretty easy, like, their last four games. Like, they could win the West. They should win the West. They play Tulane, Tulsa, SMU, and East Carolina, three of those at home. Do you think, like, that win last night sealed up the West?
I still think SMU has a chance. But I think Memphis is in the driver's seat.
Yeah, Memphis is like a weird team, right? Because they obviously have the offense to score on anybody, but I mean you're playing an SMU team that can also do that. So like anything fluky that happens at a game that goes against Memphis and they're basically screwed. Like that's all SMU needs. Like SMU just needs like a couple of extra free possessions and they could beat Memphis.
SMU's schedule, let's say, close out. Like, they play Central Florida at Navy at Memphis, like their three November games. Like I think that stretches a little bit too tough for them to get through. And like, Memphis would have to lose another league game for Navy to get the tiebreaker. Like I don't know. I don't really see it. I think Memphis, that win last night pretty much cleared it. Unless they like lose at Tulsa somehow. Or, like, Tulane somehow be done.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right, Scott. I think Memphis is in the driver's seat. I mean, it's basically their division to lose at this point. And I doubt it's probably pretty unlikely that they're really going to give up that, that spot.
They could just give up a ton of points again and then just ruin everything I just said, make me look stupid.
you just never know.
UConn beat Tulsa 28, or UConn beat Temple 28-24. Tulsa, like, destroyed Houston, like, in a crazy upset, a precursor to Houston's collapse this week. And Tulane lost to FIU at home by 13 points.
I'm doing all that good work.
Yeah, what the hell, Tulane? What the hell? I don't think any of us really picked Florida International to have like a puncher's chance in that game. Like, I thought Tulane was going to roll them.
Yeah, like, the hike after scoring 48 or 49 against Tulsa in the first half, like, just come out and lay 10 against FIU is like incredibly disappointing. Like, it like kind of like brings down their attempt for a bowl game.
Yeah, they had to win that one. I mean, they can still get there, but that they had to have.
Let's move on to this week. Tulsa goes to UConn as a 5.5-point favorite. It's kind of surprising. I thought that one would be a little bit tighter. Over-under is 75 points. I think the craziest thing about this year is how UConn's over-unders are so incredibly high. And then at the same time, it seems like they aren't high enough.
Yeah, they have an offense now. It's weird.
Yeah, I think we were talking about this last week. Like, UConn actually has a decent passing offense. Like, they're not just a team that just basically grinds the ball, you know, 60, 70 times a game. Like, they actually pass the ball a little bit. They don't play defense, so they're effectively... They're effectively like an AAC West team playing in the AAC East. Like, they're Tulsa or Temple. They're our version of Tulsa or Temple this year. Somehow. I don't know how that happened, but that's just who they are.
Do you guys think that UConn pulls off the upset, or are they going to get sent back with another loss? They've somehow won two games. I guess that's good for UConn.
I feel like UConn always has this innate ability to win fluky games when they get teams to come into the rent at noon, especially if they have to travel far. So I wouldn't have put it past UConn to pull the upset. I mean, it's less than a touchdown, so.
They can get there, but Tulsa's coming off a pretty big win. They're probably feeling confident. So yeah, UConn's definitely going to win that now that I said that out loud.
Yep. Makes sense.
Tulsa, like, such a weird team to get a handle on. Like, some weeks they throw it, and, like, the other weeks they run it. Then they always lose. But, I guess we can stop talking about Tulsa. Temple goes to Army. Temple is a 6.5-point underdog. Yeah, I think Army's going to take this one down. Although, I think it'll be closer than the spread.
Yeah, I think that makes, I mean, yeah, over-under is 45.5. That's probably about eight, but I think, yeah, I think Army wins by, like, a touchdown. Like, Temple's not as bad as they showed earlier in the season. Maybe that's just the hangover of new coaching staff, but...
No, they're pretty bad.
They're pretty bad, yeah, but they're not, like, get blown out by Army bad.
Army is pretty good. For Army.
Yeah, they're good for... That's the thing, yeah. The qualifier. They're good for Army, but they're not, like... I don't think they're going to blow them out.
Army
did. No, but I think Army will win it.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I'm just saying I don't think they win by more than, like, maybe a field goal or two.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be a lot of field goals. The over-under is 45.
Yeah.
Yeah, they learned real quick with that insane Temple UConn over-under last week to, like, knock that one right down. UCF goes to Navy in a really interesting game. UCF is like a 7-point favorite. I'm really looking forward to this game. I think it's the exact same time as the UC game, so I can't keep like a real great eye on it. But no, I think if it's going to go sideways for UCF, it might be against Navy. That's just a really tough team to get like a get your hooks in. Like and Navy's offense, they turned it over a ton last week against Memphis, and that's why they lost. But then they only lost by 3. Like, you know, Navy is going to score. That should be a pretty fun game.
No, but UCF has a secret weapon. Didn't you guys see the video? Yeah, they have this really good scout team option quarterback. His name's Scott Frost. He's a pretty big dude. A lot faster than Zach Abey. So, yeah, I think they have the best scout team quarterback imaginable.
I did see that video, and it was rather hilarious. And I'm kind of surprised if a video didn't emerge of Luke Fickell playing that role before they played Navy. Missed opportunity, I guess.
No, if he was going to play that role, it would be as a nose guard, diving wildly at the fullback, because that's what he played. Yeah, I think in the end, UCF is too good, too balanced to fall in this game. The other thing is, I don't think Navy has any answer for Mackenzie Milton. Nothing. They have no answer.
I think that's where they ultimately fall. It's like UCF's offense is really explosive, and I don't see how they can hold them down that long. But really, like, all Navy needs to do is just get a couple of stops and get their chance. I don't know. That should be a really fun game. UCF goes to Tulane. Yeah, USF goes to Tulane. Pardon. They're a 12-point favorite. Over-under, that one's only 54, which it seems like it should be higher, since USF scores 30 in, like, every game. They tied, like, the record with the UC game. I kind of think this game is going to be a shootout. I'm calling a shootout.
Yeah, over-under is the lowest, like, one of the lowest of the weekends at 54. Yeah, between Central Florida and Navy and South Florida and Tulane, I mean, two pretty watchable games for the first time in a while in the conference. Yeah, I mean, either Central Florida or South Florida trip up, and it's chaos in the conference. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, USF is a 12-point favorite, but, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they stumble against Tulane. I mean, Tulane's just feisty. Like, they're a weird team this year. They, you know, they put up 62 points and then they only put up 10 against FIU. It's just weird.
Yeah, I don't think Tulane has a shot. I just don't. They're a nice story, but USF is just better.
They have to shock and awe them early, like, to have any chance. They'd have to, like, just jump out crazy in front and put USF on their heels. It's like, you know, at some point USF's just going to clear down. That should be pretty interesting. Then we end with the, like, least interesting game of the week, probably. With BYU, who's 1-6, against East Carolina, who is also terrible. I guess this is BYU's, like, drive to a bowl game after their disappointing start to the season.
But no, that drive, it drove into a cliff. This is the worst BYU team in, like, 40 years, right? And they're 6-point favorites on the road at ECU. Let's tell you something about how bad ECU is.
BYU's schedule, like, to close is very soft. They play, like, the best team they play is Fresno State to end the year. They are really bad as well. They got destroyed last week. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you front-load your schedule with LSU, Utah, Wisconsin, and Boise State, and Mississippi State. I guess there'll be some balance, I guess, but, yeah, I mean, not a very fun start of your 2017 season when you're replacing Bronco Mendenhall as your head coach.
BYU is averaging 11 points a game, and they're in a game where the over-under is 58. just think about that for like a second. Like, that's how bad East Carolina's defense is. Where a team averaging 11 points a game is like has an over under of 58.
They're very
East Carolina is awful.
Yeah. Should have kept Ruffin McNeil.
What a terrible firing that was. That was head scratching at the time.
And yeah, they are definitely in Glenn Mason territory.
I'm sure we'll talk about this when UC plays them, but man, is like there anything they can do to turn this around, or are they just like screwed for the next few years?
They're screwed. They've got to find lightning in the bottle at the head coaching position. Otherwise, they're rather fucked. I mean, because like if you're in East Carolina, you're in state, you're recruiting against North Carolina, NC State, Duke. Over the border, you've got Virginia and Virginia Tech. You're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you just got to find that guy at head coach to bring it together. I mean, that guy was Ruffin McNeil, and they let him walk. So they've just got to try to find lightning in a bottle again.
Don't forget about Superpower Wake Forest.
Oh yeah, Mighty Wake Forest. How could we forget about them?
Close with basketball. The AAC had their media day this week. And I would say, kind of surprisingly, Cincinnati is the favorite to win the league. Cincinnati got 7 first place votes. Wichita State got 5. UC beat them by 1 point. Which kind of makes me think that somebody voted Wichita State to finish like 3rd. It seems has to be the only way the math works or something. I don't, or somebody picked UC to finish 3rd. And that's why they had 116 points. I don't know. They should have released the whole thing. But UC, Wichita State, UCF, surprising 3rd. Then SMU and UConn round out the top 5. Did you guys have any surprises from that? Or did you guys expect UC to be the preseason favorite?
I mean, UC only, I mean, they were the preseason favorite by, what, 1 vote, something like that, or 1 point, or however it figures. I mean, they're basically neck and neck with Wichita State. So, I'm not surprised by that. Because, I mean, effectively, it's probably going to be Wichita State and Cincinnati fighting it out throughout the season. So, yeah, that all makes sense to me.
Yeah, I was surprised that they were named the preseason favorite, because I thought Wichita State was just going to have that. But I'm like, you know, we're talking about a point. So that kind of shook out how I thought it. I was surprised to see no one from UC on the preseason all league, even though UConn had a guy, even though they're predicted to finish like 5th. So that makes sense.
Yeah, a couple questions about that. I guess I was kind of surprised that there was 5 guards that got the first team, and then I guess I don't understand how they leave Gary Clark off that list or Jacob Evans. So 2 questions there. I want answers.
Well, I'm pretty sure UC didn't have a player on the first team to end last year, did they? No, they didn't. Jalen Adams and was the first teamer last year. So it's really no surprise he ended up back on the first team this season. Same with Rob Gray. He was on the first team last year. Of course, Landry Shamet is like the best player on Wichita State. I kind of thought he would be the preseason player of the year. I was kind of surprised he didn't make it. But B.J. Taylor making it over Evans, I think, was a bit of an upset.
Yeah, that was inexplicable. B.J. Taylor. I think what this voting shows is that the AAC media members prefer volume over quality. because
that's it.
Rob Gray shot like 32% from the field, and that's an exaggeration, but not much of one. Same thing for BJ Taylor. You know, like, these are volume shooters. These are guys who put up a ton of shots are going to get numbers because they shoot the ball 20 times a night. No one on Cincinnati is ever going to shoot the ball more than 10 times a night. That's just how this program works. So no one's going to get the numbers. And I get that, but at a certain point, like, as media members, aren't you supposed to be, like, savvy enough to be like, oh, yeah, like, he doesn't get great numbers because they play, like, at the pace of a glacier. And they share the ball really well, so no one gets numbers. But this guy is really good. Like, Jacob Evans is really good. But no shit, really. I didn't know that Jacob Evans was good. I've heard tale of his being good, but I didn't know that. So thank you for telling me, media member. Yeah, it's a little bit frustrating.
No, and that's the thing, is like, these preseason rankings value only a couple of stats over everything else. I mean, you could put up, you could be throwing up, you know, 32% bricks, but, or I mean, you could be hitting 32% of your shots, essentially you'd be shooting bricks, but if you're like a BJ Taylor and averaging 17.4 points per game coming into your senior season, I mean, that just looks better than a Gary Clark who averages 10 points a night, hits 53% of his shots, and is one of the most efficient players in the league. I mean, let's just face it, the media members are lazy, and they're basically looking at a couple of stats, and they're not looking at the overall picture. And at the end of the day, the preseason season rankings, they don't mean dog shit, and it really just matters what happens at the end of the season. And call me bitter, but that's just how I feel.
Yeah, like you mentioned all guards. Like, if it's going to be all guards, like when you see his best... I wouldn't say they're best two players, but like, I think Evans is their best player. But like, their two best players who had a shot to make it would be, like, you would think Clark and Washington. And if they're not going to put any forwards on the team, like, that goes their chance. I think Washington was the only guy who made the first or second team last year who didn't get a whiff of this. So yeah, I think that's a little bit surprising, but. I don't know. I can't really object too much now. Except for, like, B.J. Taylor just seems weird. Unless he had to get votes for Player of the Year. That's the only way he could have ended up on the first team.
But how?
He's the best player on the team. Like, obviously, somebody thought UCF would be, like, a top two team at some point. UC only ended up with 116 points.
I mean, UCF is going to be good because they're going to be good on defense because they're employing a tone pull, which is helpful if you put it right in front of the rim. But they're not a good team, period. Like, they don't score, which is, as all UC fans know, is part of the game. You got to score.
As a team, they don't score. But as a player, he does score. Which makes him stand out. Yeah, if UC just, like, funneled all their points, if they went back to the Dante Vaughn era, like, funneled all their offense through one player, maybe he would have made the first team.
I mean, that's kind of what they did with SK, and he became an All-American.
Yeah, I, like, totally whiffed on that one. Like, the best player, like, recent memory, and I just forgot he was the first team, like, unanimous All-American.
Yeah, SK, the American Conference's energy player, or whatever the hell he was awarded at the end of the season. The spark guy? I don't even know. What was it? It was like, just give this guy a participation award because we didn't have the balls to actually give him real awards.
A terrible break for SK. Like, of all the eras of the AAC to come in, who came up, like, the two guys that got drafted?
Yeah, and of those three guys, he's the only one still in the NBA.
Right. Yeah, what was the award they gave him? I'm looking it up right now.
That's like some weird sportsmanship award or something.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, it was like a sportsmanship award. Like, what? They just basically invented an award because they didn't have the balls to give him Player of the Year. Whatever.
I wouldn't go that far. It's not like Shaz Napier was like a terrible player, and that team did win like the national title.
I said whatever, Scott. I stand by my statement.
I don't think we mentioned it. Shook Milton was the preseason player of the year. So kind of a surprise. And Ochanik Gilbert, preseason rookie of the year. So I think he was the preseason rookie of the year last year, but he got hurt, so he didn't play. I don't really want to look it up, so I'll just say that's right. And he did it 2 years in a row. He was a high-profile recruit.
Yeah, it's not something you see every day. A newcomer of the year. Still newcomer of the year.
It's probably something you don't want to repeat twice. You guys have anything else to add? I guess we should talk about the preseason top 25, which is notable because the preseason top 25 in basketball, always garbage. But notable, UC is ranked 13th, which is their highest ranking since the Kenyon year of 2000. And they play four top 20 teams, which is pretty exciting, just like looking at the picture from like a big big picture scheme.
Yeah, they finally got a real non-conference schedule. It only took like 5 years of consistent bitching, but we got it.
Yeah, it should be. They should have the makings of a high seed in a Final Four run if they at least have a winning record against. You know, what is it? Florida, Mississippi State, Xavier, Iowa, I guess they're playing in the Canes.
And I don't know. Most successful program in the history of college basketball. UCLA.
Okay, why did I blank on that? Damn it.
I am wondering the same thing.
Especially since UCLA had such a big impact on the end of the season last year.
Yeah, they played them. I don't know. That's my problem. I'm old. Hell, I was up at 5 a.m. Screw you guys.
I was up at 10, so.
Oh, okay.
It's my day off. I'm not getting up for anything.
What is a day off?
It's these things you get when you work one job and don't have kids.
Ah, okay. That must be nice.
I enjoy them. Yeah, they're very nice.
Rub it in.
Hey, you'll get some in about 18 years.
Dear God, this is so sad. What is this sleep you speak of?
It's my favorite hobby.
It is it's mine too. I just don't know what it's like.
That sounds like a joke, but that's true. I love sleep so much. If I get an hour, I'm taking a nap. I take a nap on the shower in my car. Because sometimes you got to nap. You just got to nap.
I live off of naps, so I totally hear that. I haven't had 7 hours of non-contiguous sleep in at least a year. So yeah, I hear you on naps. Get them when you can get them.
That sounds real awesome. That makes me want to go out and have children.
Yeah. So yeah, get out there and procreate.